Hi, everyone. My name is Jim Shaw, and I'm an alcoholic. Hasn't this been a wonderful convention?
Yeah.
Up to now. I really am glad to be here. I'm always honored when I'm asked to share at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm always nervous. And I'll get over it in a little while, but I do want to thank the committee for inviting Benoit and I to come and share with you. And that's what it really is. It's sharing our experience, strength, and hope. I want to thank Tony for all the wonderful phone conversations before we got here. And for Bill and Margie for being such a wonderful host and hostess. And Pam for just doing anything we needed. It's really been a good weekend. I was told before I got up here that it just so happens my sponsor is here. And I was told when I got up here to say that I agree with everything that Clancy said. And so I've done my job. Now, he said, then you can sit down. So I tell you what, I'm supposed to share a little bit about what it's like and what it used to be like, what happened and what it's like now. What it was like was bad. And what happened was, boy, I had all I could take. And what it's like now is, it's wonderful. And that really can sum it up right about there. I got here about like any other alcoholic that I know of. I drank too much, too long, and humiliated and embarrassed myself and family and children and wives and mothers and fathers, and I just couldn't handle any more of it. And that's exactly how I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you don't mind, I'll start with the day that I called Alcoholics Anonymous. The day I called Alcoholics Anonymous, I was beat. And I had just gotten out of the Los Angeles County Jail. I'm a thief, by the way. That's why I was in jail. I had been managing a guy's apartment house, and that was about all I could do. And I had taken a little money that belonged to him. And, in fact, I set up two sets of books, one for him and one for me. And they frowned on that. And so they put me in the jail. And I'd gotten out on bail. And I had never been in jail. I had an overnighter one time in San Antonio for a DUI, but I hadn't been in for anything like that, nor had anybody in my family that I knew of. And I was ashamed and humiliated and embarrassed. And when those bars clunked on me that time, I really was desperate. And when I got out, I said, I'm not going to do that anymore. And I was drinking, not round the clock, but very close to it. And when I got out, I walked down the street. I had 25 cents left in my, I had my last suit that I had. I had 25 cents in my pocket. And they opened the door and said, okay, you're free to go. And I had no job. One more wife had gotten rid of me. And I was walking down Broadway in Los Angeles, and I was a desperate and lonely human being. And I went in and I'd read in the jail where this guy wanted a credit manager in his jewelry store. So I walked in there and got that job before I went anywhere else. It was a good thing I did, because it was something I needed to do. And anyway, I got me a hotel, and I was staying in a hotel in downtown Los Angeles, the Lancashire Hotel at the corner of 7th and Broadway. Now, that's not your plush hotel over there, I can assure you, but it was all I could afford. And I went in there, and I went to work there, and I worked hard for that week, and I thought, you know, I'm just not going to do that anymore, but came payday. And I hadn't had anything to drink in about 65 days for the first time in 20-some years. I hadn't had anything for 60-some days to drink. So I said, well, I'm going to cool it for a while, and I did until payday, and I went over to my favorite watering hole, and I had been drinking Cokes in that favorite watering hole all week long. And then I said, oh, to hell with it, and I had me a double shot and a beer back. And that started about 3 weeks of suicidal-type drinking. And I was working and drinking and working and drinking, and the guy I was working for was a lush, and he didn't care, so that's what I did. To make a very long story short, the day came when I just couldn't. One day I woke up, and I had doing my usual thing. I woke up in the morning. I didn't really wake up. I came to, because I had been drinking, round-the-clock type stuff, and I would pass out and come to and pass out and come to. And I came to this one morning, and I did my usual puking routine, and then got one down after a while, and it stayed down. And I was a projectile puker is what I was. Maybe a few of you out there, And I tell you, the desperation that I remember from those days is something I never want to forget, because I don't want to go back there. And I called this next day, and I called in at work and said, boy, I really don't want to come in. Well, we need you real bad. Come on in to work. And so I came in. I went in, and I finished out the day, and then I drank real heavy into the night. And I'd been thinking about suicide a lot. And so I drank all day long, and then about 2 o'clock in the morning, I thought this suicide was a good idea. And I opened the window to this old hotel room, and I got out on the ledge, and I was on the 7th floor. I looked out there, and I said, yeah, that'll do it. That's far enough, and it'll do it. And I don't remember any fear, and I just went out there, and I stood on that, sat on that ledge, and I says, hey, this is your last part of it, man. What are your last thoughts going to be? And I sit there, and I started thinking. You know how we are when we get to thinking. And I thought about, gee whiz, I wonder how they're going to find me and what I'm going to look like when they find me. And then I thought about, what about that suit I got down the cleaners? And, strange thing come to your head when you're committing suicide. And I thought, my God, man, this is ridiculous. But I really was not afraid. And so I was just trying to urge myself onto it. And the only thing that came to my mind was I thought about those two kids that I had abandoned back in Oklahoma. And I hadn't done anything for and hadn't been a father to or anything like that. And then I was going to leave them a suicidal father. And I just could not do it. I just couldn't do it. So when I was in jail, my public defender attorney had said, Jim, you have a drinking problem, and you really ought to do something about it. I suggest very strongly that you call Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, he's talking to an alcoholic, a very sensitive alcoholic. And I looked at him with all the disdain that I could muster, and I said, who, me, call those people for help? You've got to be kidding. He just kind of shook his head, and he says, no, Jim, I wasn't kidding. I said, well, I don't legally have to do that, do I? And he looked at me, and he says, no, Jim, you don't legally have to do it, but I strongly suggest it. And so with all the arrogance of an alcoholic, I just looked at him. I said, I think I'll pass, thank you. And so he says, okay, I'll do the best I can do. Anyway, he did get me out on bail, and that's how I got out there. And he also suggested me calling one more time. He suggested that I call Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I, just at this time in the morning, after I'd come in out of the window there, the only thing I could think of to do was to call Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. So I called. The only amenity I had in the room was a phone. And I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and of course there was nobody there, and I just hung up. And so I went through my routine of going back to sleep, and the next morning I woke up. And the strange thing that happened, I don't know about you, when I was in my cup, I liked to use the telephone a lot. I know none of you ever did, but I liked to use the phone, and I always had brilliant ideas when I was about two-thirds in my cup. Many mornings, about 2 or 3 in the morning, I've called the President of the United States. Supreme Court justices and governor of California. And, you know, I mean, that just in the next morning, you know, after you'd think about doing that the night before, good Lord, how could you do something like that? That's stupid, you know. Well, this morning when I came to, I thought about the same way. The only difference was that I couldn't get Alcoholics Anonymous the night before, and it was a good idea still to try to get them. So I knew that, in retrospect, of course, I know that my higher power is working for me, but I didn't know it then. But I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and, we're not all honest as we can be when we first get here. What I did is I called Alcoholics Anonymous to get some information for a friend. And I got a hold of this lady, and my name is Jim Shaw, and I'd like to get some information about your program for a friend of mine. And the lady knew who the friend was. And so she started talking, and she says, oh, yes. And then she starts telling me parts of her story. I said, what the hell is with this lady? I just asked to get some information about the meetings and stuff, you know. And she starts telling me parts of her story. And she just got me in the conversation finally, and I was one of these kind of macho guys that I didn't want to show any emotion or cry or anything like that. And all of a sudden, I felt a lump coming in my throat when she was talking about how she'd abandoned two kids, and I thought about my two kids back there, you know. And I thought, oh, my God, has this woman been reading my mail or what, you know? And so anyway, all of a sudden, she says she was talking about something, and she asked me a question, and, oh, she made a comment like, oh, yes, I understand. I'm an alcoholic, too, you know. And boy, with that, I just went, and I sobbed, and I sobbed, and I boo-hooed, and I boo-hooed, and I... And she just let me go, boy. She just let me go. And finally, she says, could I ask you a question? Could it possibly be that friend that you wanted to get some information for, could it possibly be you? I said, yeah. And I was crying some more. You know, I just went on and on and on. And then she just let me go. And she says, oh, thank God. Thank God. Because if you're an alcoholic like I'm an alcoholic, we have the answers for you here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Won't you let me send someone out to talk to you? Now, this lady had gotten much to look inside me that nobody had been in years, you know, and so it was back off time. Well, no, I couldn't possibly do that. You see, I'm at work and I couldn't have anybody, and just went on with a whole lot of excuses, and she just let me go. She said, well, could I have a male member of Alcoholics Anonymous call you? That's the way we do it here. Men work with men, women work with women. And I would like to have him call you. Yes, he can call me here on my unlisted phone. And I gave her the number, you know. And so in a little while, about an hour, I thanked her very profusely for all her help. And yes, it really was nice of her. And I think you have a wonderful program. And she knew I was giving her the goodbye, you know. But nevertheless, in about an hour, Tom called. He says, my name is Tom, and I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Does anyone there have a problem with alcohol? Now, this guy had a very, very enunciated, his tone of his voice was very enunciated, everything, his grammar was perfect and all that. So I thought I'd answer him in kind. And he says, yes, I think I may have been an alcoholic for about the past 2 weeks. He later said, I damn near busted out laughing with that one, Joe. So he says, well, so we made arrangements to meet in front of my hotel after I got off work. He says, by the way, do you think that you could not drink for the rest of the day? I said, oh, no. He said, but we don't drink here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, well, I'm in the wrong place already, mister. You don't understand. I drink all the time. I drink all day and all night, and I got to have something to drink or I just go crazy. And about now, I need another drink. Right now, just talking to you. And he says, but, do you think you could try not to drink for the rest of the day? I said, well, I can try, but I don't promise you anything. And he says, okay. You try, and I'll meet you tonight in front of your hotel. So About, now this was 9:30 in the morning. And about noon, I kept on drinking, and about 1 o'clock, I kept on, and then at 2 o'clock, I had to have another one, and I said, you know what? That guy said don't drink for the rest of the day. Maybe you ought to stop for the rest of the day and don't drink. And so I said, well, okay, I'll do that. So I sweated it out, and I didn't drink for the rest of the day. But, I mean, by the time that I got down there and, from that in front of that hotel waiting for him, I am not in good shape. I'm sweating clear through my suit, and I am not feeling well, and I'm beginning to get a little bit of this, and so I needed some medicine. And about that time, why, this car pulled up in front of the hotel. And, now, the hotel, there was, must have been 25, 30 people standing there waiting for buses, rides, whatever. And I'm standing there, and this car comes around there, and the car stops, and this guy gets out of the car, and he just kept on getting out, man. I mean, he was, you know, that big, tall guy. And he just kind of panned the crowd like this. And then he saw me, and he just pointed his finger over there, and he started walking toward me. And he walked over, and he said, are you Jim? I says, yes, I'm Jim. But how'd you know who I was? He says, you're kidding. And nevertheless, he says, hi, Jim, I want you to know that no matter how big that list of problems that you had this morning was, that right now it's just been cut in half. And I said, what the hell is he talking about, you know? He says, he says, the reason for that is, he says, before any problems can be taken care of, and when it comes to alcoholism, you have to ask and you have to have the desire to stop drinking. You now have that. And that just cuts in half the size of your problems. I said, I don't know what the hell he's talking about, but I guess it's all right, you know. And so he says, come on, let's go to a meeting. Oh, no, he said, come on, let's go eat. Oh, that I was not really in the mood for eating. I didn't do a whole lot of eating. I ate a lot of chili is what I ate. About the only thing I could eat was chili. And so I did my thing with him, and I said, no, thank you, I really don't want to. But he wanted me to anyway, and so we went into this place over there in this restaurant, and he finally made me order some soup. So I finally got the soup down, and I told you I was a projectile puker. And I'm sitting there across from him, talking to him and what have you, and with absolutely no warning whatsoever, right over into his lap. And he started laughing. I said, if it had been me, I'd have been madder than hell. He started laughing. He said, well, I insisted. Oh, Lord have mercy. And I was embarrassed and what have you, you know, but hell, nothing I could do about it. And so he got the waitress to get him a rag and wiped himself off, and we went to a meeting. Now, we went into this place over in Hollywood, and I want to tell you something. Half a block away, you could see the smoke boiling out of it, you know, out of the basement. We get in there, and by this time, I'd been telling him all along, the problem is I haven't had a drink since 2 o'clock, and I really, really need a drink. And I said, we better stop before we get over there in order to get me a drink, because, man, I'll come apart. He says, I'll tell you what, you just hang on for another 15, 20 minutes. If you have to have one, I'll see to it that you get it. Okay. We get over there, and one more time I hit him up for a drink. No, he put me off. And so we get to this meeting. And I want you to know, in the shape I was in, it was not real good anyway. I get in there, and these people came in. All these people were around me, and they all came at me when they brought him in, when he came in with me, and they all looked at me, and they're saying, hi, how are you? God Almighty, you know, I mean, they just were all loud, real loud. And I'm not in good shape at all. And by this time, I'm beginning to have a little bit of the leaps, not the jumps or anything, but the leaps, you know, and it was really getting serious. And finally, he says, hi, I want you to meet Jim. He's new. Hi, Jim, how are you? God, get out of here, you know. And so the meeting began. It was one of these kind of meetings where they have participation first, and then they have a speaker afterward. So this first one gets up and talks. This called the leader calls on this lady, and she gets up, trots over to the mic. "My name is Sue, and I've been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous for 6 months, and it's just wonderful. It's just changed my life, and I'm just so happy." And that somehow or another hit me wrong, and I somewhere my head just went out the window or something, and I had to comment on what she had to say. And so I stand up and I say, "Ah, BS, lady, BS." Tom looks at me. "So Jim, what the hell's wrong with you? Shut up." And I was embarrassed because I didn't realize what I'd done, and it was just a mess. And so I sat back down again. Next guy gets up. The guy gets up and he said, "My name is Paul. I've been Alcoholics Anonymous 4 months. Boy, it's rough out there. I mean, it's rough out there." I understood Paul, and I really had to respond to Paul. So I get up again. "You're right, Paul. It sure as hell is rough out there." And Tom looks at me and grabs hold and pulls me down. "Jim, if you don't shut up, we're going to have to get you out of here. What the hell's wrong with you? Can't you keep your mouth shut?" Oh, and I was embarrassed again, and I just, I was crazy is what I was, folks. It was just that simple. I was just nuts. So finally, I sat still, and in about a year and a half later, that meeting was over, and... And they says, "Come on, we're going to go over here, and I'm going to get you that drink." Oh, thank God. And so we get over there, and I noticed a bunch of other people going over there, too. And we went over to this place called Sherry's over on Santa Monica Boulevard. And we went in there, and we walked in there with Tom. He seemed to know the hostess there. He says, "We want that booth right over there." And went over there and got that booth. And... he put me on the inside. It's the only booth in the house where they could seat six. And they put me on the inside and put a fullback next to me. And, six other people in there. And Tom says to me, I said, look over at Tom. He was sitting on the end. "Tom, where's my drink? I really need my drink." And he said, "Oh, yeah, waitress, come here a minute. See that man back there? He's in bad shape. He needs a drink. Would you bring him a great big glass of iced tea?" And I turned loose on Tom. "You dirty son of a gun, you promised me this," he said. And then he got serious with me. He got real serious with me. He looked at me, he says, "Jim, you see all these people that came with us from that meeting over here? They all had a time of day that they had their last drink. Now, you told me that you had yours around 2 o'clock this afternoon. Why don't we let 2 o'clock be the time for your last drink?" I said, "But you don't understand, Tom. You really, really don't understand. I drink all the time. I have to drink. It's not a question of wanting to. I have to drink all the time. And I am dying right now because I don't have a drink. And you expect me not to drink at all?" He said, "Well, every one of us had to go through the same thing. And we're here, and we haven't had a drink in varying lengths of time, but we all had to go through the same thing. Won't you try?" Okay, I'll try. And my God, just by saying that, I just turned on a light bulb. Everybody just grinned, and the guy across from me started talking, "Jim, you're going to love Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is the best deal I ever had." And he was just jubilant as hell. The next guy over here, "Jim, Alcoholics Anonymous has changed my life. It's just going to be wonderful." And the next guy, he was telling me how wonderful AA was. And the next guy down here just chimed right in. They didn't miss a beat. Boy, they just clicked it right on through. And by the time they got around to me, man, I was tired out. And I just laid my head down on the table a little bit like this. And I heard some movement going on, some rustling around going on. But I didn't care. I'm just laying there, and I had my head down like that. And when I finally did come back up, I looked, and they'd done... ran in a whole new crew, and they began to tell me how wonderful AA was. Boy, I really learned how wonderful Alcoholics Anonymous was that first night. And so that's really where it started. That's really where it started. And so they took me to the hotel, and Tom took me up, and he, I had already made up my mind. I watched that clock. Now, I know I'd told him I was going to try not to drink again, but I knew I wasn't going to be able to handle that either. And I was watching that clock because I had a half pint of vodka back in the room. That's all I had. And I always had a reserve. I mean, I always had a reserve. And so I started back there, and I was thinking, well, I'll just jump right out of this car and go right on up to my room when I get through, when they take me back. When it took me back, why, I was talking to the guy that was driving, Bob. And when I started to get out, well, Tom was already out. And he looked down at me. He says, "Jim, are you going to pour it out or am I?" "What are you talking about?" Like I didn't know what he was talking about. And I says, "What are you talking about?" He says, "That bottle that you got up in your room." I said, and I started to give him some kind of excuse and all this, and I said, "This man's got my number. He has got my number," and I just said, "If it gets poured out, you're going to have to pour it out, because I sure as heck can't." And so he says, "Come on, let's go get that job done." He went up there, and he said, on the way up there, he said, "Now, one of us will stay with you tonight, Jim, because it's going to get rough. The way you drink, it's going to get rough." And I said, "I already know that, mister." And he said that one of them would stay with me so that it wouldn't have to drink. And I said, "No, I'll do it. Well, anyway, went up there and poured that thing out, and I nearly cried because I knew there was nothing between me and 6 o'clock in the morning, you know, to do anything, to change things. So the next morning, that phone was the only thing I had. Thank God for that phone. And he told me, he gave me his number and said, "If you need me, call me. Any time tonight or whatever, if you need me, call me. If you feel like you're going to drink, call me." So I made it through the night. I didn't sleep at all. You know I didn't sleep at all. And the next morning came and the phone rang, and I jumped like heck when it rang, and it was Tom. "Jim, did you have to drink last night?" "No, I didn't have to drink last night, but I don't know why in the hell I didn't. It's the craziest idea I ever saw in my life. I don't know why in the hell I'm not drunk right now. I should be," and it just went on and on and on. And he let me go. Finally, he says, "I'd be surprised if you felt any different than that, Jim, but," he says, "don't drink and we'll go to another meeting tonight." And I said, "Oh, just wonderful." And I was not really the nicest guy. And so then about an hour later, Bob, the guy that was driving the car, he called. "Jim, did you have to drink last night?" "No, I didn't have to drink last night, Bob." And then I calmed down a little bit. "And I sure want to thank you, Bob, for trying to help me." And I'll tell you what, I went to work, and they called that unlisted phone that nobody was supposed to have. Every hour on the hour, somebody knew from that bunch last night who was calling, "Jim, did you have to drink last night?" "No, I didn't have to drink last night. Thank you very much." And so they'd call me all day long. Now, I want to tell you, the reason I tell that story is because that's the way it happened with me. And that's the way that my life in AA began. And I never will forget those people, all those people, with their concentration on just one guy, trying to give him a chance to change the way he lived. And every single one of them meant it. And a lot of them had to get up and go to work, yet they stayed there till 2 o'clock in the morning so that one guy wouldn't have to drink during that length of time, and they could share their experience, strength, and hope. That's always impressed me. It also reminds me every time I talk about it, about the obligation that I have. And that obligation is that when anyone, anywhere, reaches out for help, I have got to be there. And that's my personal responsibility. It's my personal obligation. Don't ever want to forget it. As long as I live, I don't ever want to forget that. Anyway, you know, it's a funny thing. I was thinking about, trying to think about what I was... I never know what I'm going to say when I get up here. But I was trying to think about what I was going to say today, and one of the things I know I wanted to bring, the things that I didn't want to talk about is, I didn't want to get up here, and you're not going to hear from me talking about my inner child. You're not going to hear from me talking about how it was my parents' fault that I'm an alcoholic. You won't hear that from me, because I don't believe that. You're not going to hear from me that all these other outside things are going to help me with my alcoholism, because that was not the case. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous was the thing that that allowed me to continue my sobriety once it started. And so I like to discuss what happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous and the way it came about. You see, it was very, very important in my early sobriety that I have a sponsor. Now, I didn't know that because I wouldn't get one. I was going to these meetings. Tom was picking me up and other guys were picking me up, and I was going to these meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they all were saying, oh, Jim, how you doing? And they all really were genuinely glad to see me. And I'd go into those meetings, and after a while, they started, maybe I was there 2 months. Because they'd already mentioned several people. Jim, who's your sponsor? You got a sponsor yet, Jim? What's your sponsor's name, Jim? And it seemed to me after about a couple of months, there was just a kind of a crescendo started. You know, everybody was talking to me all the time about who my sponsor was. And when are you going to get a sponsor? Have you got a sponsor? And I thought, geez, what the hell is going on here? And one night I'm in this meeting over in a little pool hall over in Sawtelle Boulevard. And I'm sitting up in the front at the tables, one of the tables there, and I'm sitting with another guy, Byron, who, by the way, I still sit with today after 27 years. And I'm sitting there, and Byron says to me, Jim, you know, I've been watching you, and we love you around here and all that, but he says, you just got to get a sponsor. You just got to get a sponsor or you're going to get drunk. And he got my attention. Because, you know, they talked about, if you want what we have. Well, hell, I didn't know what you had, but I knew what I'd had out there, and I didn't want some more of that. So I thought, well, maybe I better think about this. And I said, okay, Byron, I'll get one of these days pretty quick. He says, Jim, I'm talking about soon. I said, yeah, okay. So help me. Not 15 seconds later, we're sitting and looking toward a door in the back there, the front door, and in walks this guy. Now, I had seen him around a lot, different meetings and what have you. Heard a lot of people talk about him. And I didn't really like him, to be honest with you. He was a kind of a smart ass. And he kind of a know-it-all. And he's some kind of a big shot. And I just hated people with any kind of authority anyway. And so he walked in the door. And Byron says, Jim, there's the guy you got to have for a sponsor. I looked at him, and I looked at him, and I looked at him, and I looked at him. I said, you got to be kidding. I can't stand him, much less have him to be a sponsor, my sponsor. Byron looked at me and said, a guy with the arrogance and the ego and the hostility that you have, Jim Shaw, needs him for a sponsor. Now you go ask him to be your sponsor. And he just kept on, and he wouldn't stop. And so I said, okay, I'll ask him. And so finally, when the coffee break came, I'll ask him at the coffee break. Coffee break came, and I kind of swaggered over to him. I didn't walk over, but I just kind of swaggered over there, and I stuck my finger right in his face. I said, listen, Clancy, you're going to be my sponsor. He looked up at me and says, I'm what? I said, you're going to be my sponsor. He looked back up and he said, listen, Puke, people don't tell me I'm going to be their sponsor. They ask me, now you get the hell out of here and come back later, and maybe I will and maybe I won't. Ooh. I looked over Byron. I went back there and I looked over him. I said, you see there, Byron, I went over there and I humbled myself. And I... He said, yeah, I saw just how much you humbled yourself. He said, now you get over there after this coffee break, when this meeting's over with, and ask him to be your sponsor. So afterwards, I went over there and I said, listen, Clancy, I really would appreciate it if you'd be my sponsor. He said, oh, I like that change in attitude. It suits you well, Jim. He says, however, I need to talk to you about a few things that I expect when I sponsor someone. If that's agreeable to you, then we can talk a little further. So he starts naming off the things that what it takes for him to sponsor people. You will be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every day of the week. I will tell you which ones. You will be there early. You will help set up the meeting. You'll go in there and you'll wash cups during the meeting if necessary. And he says, in your case, you've been here a little while, you need to be on the greeting committee. You get up by the door and say this, nothing else. My name is Jim and I'm new. But I'm not new. Yeah, you're new. My name is Jim and I'm new. And all this, and he just kept on with the list, and 30 minutes later he was still going with the list, you know. I said, gee, I can never remember that. He said, I'll be around to remind you. And so, and he says, besides that, you come down to my office and we'll talk a little bit more. And I got down to his office and he says, Jim, I want you to understand something right away. He says, I know more about you than you have any idea that I do. All that arrogance and all that hostility and everything that goes on with you is all intertwined with just one great big thing, fear. You are so full of fear that you cannot understand what's motivating you. And he said, I promise you this, if you come and do as I tell you to do, do the things that I tell you to do, work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I promise you that fear will be diminished to where you can handle it and you won't have to drink about it. Can you do that? I said, I'll sure try. And that began my road into this journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. I haven't forgotten that. I haven't forgotten that for a single minute, the anxieties and the insecurities and all that sort of thing. I haven't forgotten those at all. I know what they, in fact, they recur from time to time. They remind me that they're still there. But that Alcoholics Anonymous has been able to let me rise above them and still function. And so I want to talk today, if I can, a little bit about how important sponsorship was to me, how important my home group is to me. The one thing that I was totally full of fear was absolutely right. I had a good right to be. I owed everybody in town, even the IRS. And none of you ever got here with owing the IRS. I know that. But I owed the IRS, and I was really scared to death with everything. And I owed a lot of people a lot of money and had no idea how I was going to pay it. And I was concerned and about myself, and I had a whole lot of guilt all the time about those kids that I had abandoned back in Oklahoma. That was just a constant fear with me, a constant source of guilt was those two kids, because I was raised that you took care of your kids and that you had, you know, you took care of your responsibilities. Now, I got there and they started saying, well, we'll do this and this and this. And I said, what I really did, they started out so simple, because it had to be pretty simple with me, you know. I came to work one time and I had a pair of old raggedy jeans on and that sort of thing, and a pair of tennis shoes. And my sponsor says, what are you doing here with those clothes on? I said, well, I don't know, I just came for work. And he said, we don't come to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with hole-in-the-ass jeans, you know. We don't do that. We respect this place, and I expect you to respect it. And he said, don't you ever dare wear a cap in this meeting. This is a very special place, and don't you ever wear a cap here. Okay. But I didn't know that. My state of mind, either I didn't know or I didn't give a damn or whatever it was, but he had to point out a lot of things. And he says, by the way, you will not be in a relationship. I don't want you fooling around here at all for at least a year, especially in your case. I don't know what he meant by that. Well, I guess one of the things I had told him, see, I had a little problem with getting married. I used to get married a lot and get divorced a lot. So he felt maybe I didn't need to be into a relationship. He said stay out of it. But he directed me with each little thing that he saw, just like a father. And so finally, little by little, I began to know what was expected of me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thank God for having somebody who who didn't care about my feelings, but who did care about my actions. And he could change my feelings by me doing those actions. Those feelings could be changed. Because I don't know about you, but I came here with absolutely no self-worth. My dignity had been stripped a long time from me. And I really was a hopeless soul. And I wanted to do the things right, but I didn't really know how to go about them. And he taught me one by one, step by step. So I'm really grateful for him. And I'm grateful for the members of my group who, they were a source of strength all the time. I remember so well one time when I was maybe 6 months sober and I was scared to death. And my kids, my brother had had my kids, their mother had, her alcoholism had manifested itself. And my kids wound up with my brother. My brother called me and says, what are you going to do about your kids? And I was crazy because my sponsor says I was going to get another job and see if I couldn't do this and try to make things put together. And he says, Jim, leave those kids where they are for now. You've got to get a base here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and then you'll be able to take care of those kids. Not only will you be able to, I will insist that you take care of those kids. And so all this was going on, and I was just afraid. I was just scared. And the one thing that I said, oh, thank God, I can be in a meeting in 2 hours, and they can't get me there. Whoever they were, they couldn't get me in that meeting. And I really felt good about that. And that was the same thing every day. God, I'll be glad when I can get to the meeting, because there was a source of power in that meeting, a source of strength in that meeting that I had no idea was there. Except that I knew I felt good when I was there. I felt protected when I was there. And so that's where I went. I went to meetings all the time. Didn't have any problem with going to those 7 meetings a week. Didn't have any problem at all because I wanted to be there. And so I got that base and I got that foundation. And it was spoon-fed me by my peers and by my sponsor. And time went on. And things started coming together a little bit, little by little. I got those kids that had from my brother, and they wound up in a foster home here in the Los Angeles area. And I thought, oh, my God, my kids at a foster home, come on. Not only were they in a foster home, they'd gone over to a black foster home. And I thought, oh, come on, because at that time I was just as prejudiced as anybody you could ever think about. And it was just one of those things that I just thought that was the end, you know. And when I took those kids over there, my daughter Sheila, she was in this foster home, and I was leaving, and I looked at her, and she didn't say it, but her eyes said to me, you're abandoning us one more time, Daddy. And there was a look there that I will never forget. And my sponsor had said, it says, you will be there to visit those kids every single week, and you will contribute some to their support. I don't know how much you can contribute, but we'll figure that out. And so I went there, and the next week when I was there, I went over there, and my daughter was playing out in the front yard. And she came running over to the car, and she said, oh, Daddy, Daddy, if we had to be in any foster home, and not be with you, I am so glad it's here. This lady is so nice, and she's so good to us. I really am happy here, and I just started crying. Because there was my prejudices all in my hand, you know, and here was my daughter telling me how wonderful this lady was and how wonderful they had been treating them. That was one of my first lessons that I began for me when I found out that the color of a person's skin didn't mean a damn thing. And at Alcoholics Anonymous especially, is as colorblind as any organization I have ever seen or known of in my life, thank God. And I started to learn those lessons early. And I was thinking the other night, this past New Year's Day, generally at our house, we have a celebration and have a bunch of people over and football and all this sort of thing. I have just a real good time at my house. And people, drunks come in from all over, Al-Anons come in, you know, we just have a good time. About 4:30, quarter to 5, the phone rang. And there was a guy, Harvey, down at the central office. And he says, Jim, I got a call over here over on El Segundo Boulevard. And I really need to, I can't get anybody to take it. Can you handle it for me? And I thought, my first thought was, Now, maybe I can get one of my babies to go over there, you know. And I said, uh-uh, that is not the idea. The call came to you. And so I, okay, yeah, Harvey, I'll take care of it. And so I went over there, and here's this guy in this motel room over there, on, and his voice smells of the high heavens, you know, and he, you know, he isn't drunk. And I walked in there, and I stuck out my hand. I said, hi, my name is Jim Shaw. And if you have a problem with alcohol, we can help you. Have you ever been to Alcoholics Anonymous before? And he said, no. I said, welcome home, mister. This man was a black man. And I had a flashback of when I had first heard about, that my kids were going to go to this black foster home. And that just immediately flashed back in my head when I talked to him. And I said, Larry, I'm glad to see you. And you're going to like Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started telling him why he was going to like Alcoholics Anonymous. No, Larry, you're going to love Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm very happy to tell you that Larry is still sober, going to meetings every day, doing the same thing that was told to me. I'm very happy that I got my prejudice out of the way through the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I could be as effective messenger for this fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't ever want to forget that. And I don't want to ever be hesitant about me taking another 12-step call. And there's been a lot of things like that that's gone on, but it just, there have been so many things happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous that have changed my perspective. Everything that happened, and that's what my sponsor has been very responsible for. I can be adamant on a point, and he'll say, well, maybe you ought to try looking at this, and how about this angle of it? And before I know it, he's already changed me around and said, my thinking, I'm doubting a little bit maybe about what I was so adamant with, and thought maybe, well, maybe I'll try it his way. And that's happened a number of times. I've done it his way lots of times when I didn't believe he knew what the hell he was talking about. Lots of times. But I have never had him to really steer me in the wrong direction. Lots of things have gone on in my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. My mother died of alcoholism when she was 56. Cirrhosis of the liver. The mother of my two children died of cirrhosis of the liver. So you see, alcoholism kind of rampant in my family. I have two children of mine, and Sheila now has 9 years in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a son who works with me who's still drinking. Oh, I see me walking around every day before I came to AA. I just see me at such a... Every day I see the arrogance and the ego and the hostility and all that. And I just say, oh, man. And then I've got Tracy. And I've got Chardet now. And then we've got another long, tall drink of water. He is an alcoholic, and he's still out there. But Tracy and Sheila are 9 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, Chardet is Tracy's little girl, and she's my girl. Not Tracy's girl. She's my girl. She has Grandpa around her little finger, and she knows it. And when I first saw my first grandson, my daughter Sheila had been in... she'd been without a phone number and without an address for a while. You know, that was several times went on, but there was another time was going on. And we got a phone call, and she was calling and says she was going to put the little boy she'd had and put him in a foster home, and she was going to walk the streets. And we brought her back to Oklahoma when we were down there. And my wife, Manoy, talked her into coming back there. And she said, maybe it's time for a payback. I said, maybe so. And when she came back in there, all she had was just a box of belongings and had that little boy. And I told her before that she came back there, I'm not going to get emotionally involved with that little boy. Do you understand that? She says, yes, dear. And I said, well, I just want you to understand that. She might come back here and just drop him here and run, or she might come back here and we may have to take care of him. Well, there's 100 things that could have. She said, yes, dear. And anyway, she brought that little boy back there, and I was not going to get emotionally involved with that kid. And I didn't for about 16, 18 hours. And then he looked up, and he was about 18 months old, a little blonde-headed tyke, and he had me around his little finger, too, you know. So I've learned the joys of becoming a grandfather, and she had misplaced this youngster in a blackout, and she didn't know where he was. And, boy, that nearly sent me through the roof. And so I said, I want to see you down at my shop. So the next day she came down there, and I looked at her, and I said, honey, I want to tell you something. Your daddy loves you more than you can imagine. And I'm really sorry for the things that I did while you kids were young. I can't do anything about that. But I want you to know something else. I cannot let that happen twice in my lifetime. I will not let you do the same thing to this little boy that I did to you kids. I cannot let you do that. My alcoholism caused that, and I'm not going to let yours cause him to wind up that way. If I have to, I'll take all the legal action I need to in order to get custody of that kid. I love you, sweetheart, and I hope you do well. But I just have to tell you what's going to happen if something doesn't change. She looked at me. She said, Dad, I understand. Now, the funny part is I'm a yeller and a screamer and this sort of thing when I'm upset and concerned. My voice was very, very, very low and very to the point. She turned around and looked at me and says, I understand, Dad. That Saturday night, I was in my third row seat, which was my seat, nobody else's seat, that was my seat. And I was sitting there, and my wife says, when they asked for newcomers, my wife said, Jim, look back there. And I turned around, and there was my daughter, and she had her hand up, and she'd been 9.5 years sober now. That's a great gift that you people have given me, and you gave it to me. You just told me what to do when I came here, and you gave me the gift. That you gave me the gift of being an example that my daughter was able to follow. And I didn't knowingly know I was being an example for her, but I was. So, my dad was a drunk. And many times he had to go to the hospital, and he'd get on a bender and he'd go. And he, one day I was in California and I got a call from my brother Bill, and Bill says, Jim, if you want to see your dad alive again, you better get back here because it looks like your dad's gonna pass away. I said, okay, I'll be there in a little while. I got on the plane, and all the way back there, I was praying. I said, God, please show me how to show my dad what AA can do for him. Because he'd been to a lot of meetings with me out in California. And so I went back there and I looked at him, and he was bloated and he looked horrible and he looked like he was going to die. And I said, Dad, I didn't come back here to criticize you. You've been to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with me. You know what it's done in my life. I just want you to know that I came back here to tell you I love you one more time, because I don't think maybe I'll get a chance again. So he says, okay, son, I appreciate that. And one of the proudest, not proudest moments, one of the sweetest memories in Alcoholics Anonymous when I was, because a year later, I was able to call back and wish my 79-year-old father happy number one AA birthday. My dad lived almost to 89, and he had 10 years of sobriety when he died. And he told me on several occasions, Jim, this time in Alcoholics Anonymous has been the best years of my life. And I thought back to the time when I called back there to tell him, you know, happy birthday about his first year. And then I told him, gosh, I'm so proud of you, Dad, and I really am glad that he says, but Jim, you don't understand. I'm the ones that should be saying thank you to you, because you were my example. You were the one that showed me that you could change. All I could do was cry. I learned how to cry in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll tell you that. And I, one more time, I got another special gift from you people in this fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. But it had to all come about so I could stay here. And those steps had to be worked so I could stay here. I had to listen to a sponsor so I could stay here. And if you're new out there today, I say to you, stay here. Stay here through all the crap. Stay here through everything, because when we get here, we got a lot of changing to do. But stay here until the magic happens while we're here. And it does happen here, you know. I'll tell you what, I'm concerned a little bit about today, and I'm going to be through here in just a minute, but I'm concerned today, and I need to voice this. I've gone into some meetings that in Alcoholics Anonymous across this country that I never even dreamed they were Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. All the crap that I heard espoused in there were just, it has been so diluted in some areas, it scares me to death. I was in Dallas, Texas, not 2 months ago, and they were telling me about how just a week before that the coordinator for the group in this place, they were several people objecting because they thought the traditions were being broken real very often. And so the coordinator gets up there and says, to hell with those traditions, we're going to do what we want here. And this is a big group in Dallas. And some of the guys in it I sponsored. And when they told me that, I said, it's time for you to form a new group. You get the hell out of there, and it's time for you to form a new group. If they allow that man to get up there and say things like that, you need to be in another group. They have formed another group, and they're doing quite well with it. But when I hear things like that, ladies and gentlemen, the steps and the traditions of this group have not, they must be protected at all cost. Otherwise, we're going to lose what we got. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, my dignity had been stripped. My self-worth was gone. One of the great precious gifts that you've given me is a lovely wife who walks this road with me, and we do it together. And you've given me the fellowship and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, but most of all, I can look you dead in the eye today. I'm not chasing flies when I'm talking to you. I'm looking you dead in the eye. And I can walk straight as an arrow down the street. I don't have to hang my head, because you restored my dignity. Thank you very, very much.